Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have another figure who is familiar to First Things readers, John Witte. John is the Robert Woodruff Professor of Law and Director of the Center for the Study of Law and Religion here at Emory University, just up the road from where my office is in the English department. He has too many books, too much scholarship for me to mention, so I'll note a forthcoming volume that you list there on your CV, John. It's Church, State, and Family, Reconciling Traditional Teachings and Modern Liberties. Is that out yet?
It's coming out in 2 months.
2 months. Perfect.
Cambridge University Press, just in time for Christmas.
It can
it's
be...
too late for stocking stuffers, but it'll be a nice brick under the tree.
It can be ordered at the Cambridge University Press website, all of you out there. So, John, you started something many years ago, really before it was such an important, well, it's always been an important topic, but a discussed public topic, and that is relationships between law and religion with the center that you started. When did that begin?
So it began before I got here in 1982 with Frank Alexander.
Oh, he started, okay.
Inspired by Jim Laney, who was taking religion seriously, even in a purportedly secular university, and thought that religion and various professions and disciplines needed to be brought into conversation. And religion and law was one of them.
Right.
Frank Alexander was brought in 1982 to start it here. Harold Berman, my mentor at Harvard Law School, and I came in 1985, and I've been directing it ever since.
Very good. Was Laney a Methodist minister? Was he?
He was a Methodist clergyman and scholar. He had been dean of the Candler School of Theology, but then was appointed as university president. And his mandate was to try to find a way to create a major research university that was authentic to its tradition, but uniquely in the top 20 of universities at the time, took religion seriously as a category of knowledge, not necessarily as an object of proselytism, but not ghettoized in the Department of Religion or the Candler School of Theology, a pervasive topic that needed to be studied.
Well, one thing, John, that I've said in some recent talks lately is reflecting on my own graduate education. I was at UCLA in the 80s, studying in English, and it was a very good education that they had there, broad, erudite, generalist learning that they required of everybody. And I went into American literature, and through my entire graduate school career in the seminars and the readings courses, I was never assigned the most influential book in all of American culture and history. King James.
Yes.
Never a word of any biblical text.
QED of the importance of Laney's prescience. And the work that we did in law and religion was designed in the 1980s to deal with questions that were falling between the curricular cracks of the theology school and the law school and graduate school. Hard questions of religious legal systems.
In the mid-80s,
yep.
What were the pressing questions of law and religion? They're different from the ones now, correct?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the Establishment Clause was all the rage, and it was being interpreted by the United States Supreme Court to purge the public square and public discourse of religion. The requirement of a secular purpose, of a primary effect that neither advanced or inhibited religion, no excessive entanglement between church and state, was pushing religion increasingly into the private sphere, into the sanctuary, into religious communities, but removing it as a factor, as it historically had been, in public life, in public law, and public discourse. I think a second thing that was going on was the budding concern about religious autonomy, the ability of religious communities to operate their own internal affairs about polity, about property, about personnel, about priesthood. And there was a strong pressure in the day to begin to rein in what was considered to be an autonomous sphere that was defying conventions of the liberal polity. The third big question that was emerging was the cooperation between religious and political communities in the delivery of education, of charity, of some of the other good works in the community, the historical interaction between religion and state in delivering those services was thought to be an anomaly in a post-Christian, post-establishment era. And those questions were pressing hard on the polity. You remember the great revolution of faith-based initiatives that Bill Clinton a decade later was putting in place. In the 1980s, that was considered to be increasingly taboo. There were other issues, but those were big ones. The lingering questions of anti-Semitism, the budding questions of Islamophobia were all afoot in the 1980s as well.
And this was operating maybe broadly culturally and politically through the the 60s and 70s, but it was progressively becoming a legal issue in the 80s,
yes.
Sort of settling into, okay, the courts are going to start weighing in on this kind of thing.
Yeah, so the courts at the Supreme Court level, but also lower federal courts, especially in certain of the circuits, were zealously at work. On the one hand, reducing the power of the Free Exercise Clause, which culminated in 1990 in the Employment Division versus Smith case, where the Free Exercise Clause gave you rather little constitutional protection as an individual or a group, and at the same time, escalating the power of the Establishment Clause, which had the effect of purging public life and public law from religion.
Could you give us just a quick summary of that case?
Of the Employment Division versus Smith.
Yes.
So this was the case culminating 8 years of Supreme Court dicta that had made clear that when a party brings an action seeking the protection of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, historically that party could get an exemption from compliance with a general law that burdened substantially their conscience, their commandments, their community. In 1990, the Supreme Court said authoritatively for the first and final time that if a law is neutral and generally applicable, it is constitutional under the Free Exercise Clause, even if it imposes a crushing burden on the exercise of an individual or group's faith.
And the complainant was Native American? Is that right?
Native American who was ingesting peyote as part of a sacramental ritual at the time.
Mm-hmm. And no one doubted the sincerity of his religious motives in that practice. Is that correct?
The Supreme Court didn't doubt it, which is the most dispositive, but some in the case below did question whether this was a bona fide claim as opposed to simply a public interest case. The Supreme Court took his faith convictions as given, sincere, and in good faith, and notwithstanding that, and notwithstanding the fact that this was a sacramental ritual, not just a incidental social thing done on the side, notwithstanding that, the Supreme Court said, so sorry, a neutral, generally applicable law, in this case, one prohibiting the use of a narcotic substance, is constitutional, regardless of the burden that it casts on you. With the side note, out of the side of the court's opinion and by Justice Scalia, saying that if you want to get an exemption or an accommodation for your religion, please seek the legislature, which is exactly what Smith and his followers did, and they went to the Oregon legislature and got an exemption built into the law, introducing the statutorization, if you will, of constitutional law of free exercise.
Yeah, I haven't heard that conclusion before.
That's really, it's shifting, it's a separation of powers argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want exemptions, go to the legislature. And the argument for it, and Justice Scalia has articulated this several times in his subsequent years at both on the bench and as well as in public addresses, he would say separation of powers dictates this. Legislatures are far better positioned to do comprehensive fact-finding, not to be bound by the case below, not to be saddled with a lot of justiciability requirements. The legislature can craft legislative exemptions, macro or micro, as it wishes, which is exactly what Congress and many state legislatures did in the aftermath of Smith.
So I've heard many people criticize Scalia that this was the one decision that was harmful to the conservative cause. But in fact, conservative cause on religious freedom could continue and just operates in a different venue, not here.
Yes. I mean, as Scalia has said that. I'm not against religious freedom. I'm against a Supreme Court making judgments about religious freedom that should be left to the legislature and to the states.
Very good. Now, the center operating through the 80s on these issues, did you get any – were there any tensions in the center's work – appearing to be one-sided?
Yes, there were tensions in the sense that this was viewed as a very peculiar way of doing interdisciplinary legal study. This was viewed as a bunch of Christians proselytizing Jews or others. This was thought of as a soft subject that we're introducing into the law. And the burden of proof, properly, I think, was against us in creating this, at the time, rather new field. One of the things we did very seriously is not to take a party line in our center. We welcomed every perspective. We wanted people to be authentic in their views. We wanted to be authentic in their religious identities and profession. And so we gathered Jews and Christians and Muslims primarily in serious conversation about these fundamentals, not just about religious freedom, although that was always a baseline of conversation, but also the fundamentals of faith, freedom, and family.
Mm-hmm.
There are three things that you and I will die for: our faith, our freedom, and our family.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that in the 1990s, those were going to be centerpieces of our inquiry, and we are going to look at them internal to every religious legal tradition, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and then all the denominational particularities within them. We're going to look at them comparatively. What did those religious legal systems mean for the so-called secular or state law around them? And we're going to look at them in a deliberately interdisciplinary, interreligious sense. That is, to what extent are there wonderful flashpoints of tension or overlapping consensus that have emerged in historical and contemporary voices around these fundamental questions of faith, freedom, and family? And that was the driving engine of our projects, driving engine of our pedagogy, and it blunted the concern that some folk had about this being soft,
right,
this being unimportant to a legal education, or a chauvinist agenda of whatever parochial dimension you wish. And we were blessed with generous support from the university and then by external benefactors, and we had the privilege of putting on a number of major conferences on Christianity and democracy, religion and human rights, problems of proselytism, sex, marriage, and family in the world, religions, and more. Those brought thousands of folks to the Emory campus around these questions, and it was quite clear that those questions needed to be addressed.
It seems to me that just convening these discussions and opening up for consideration some ideas about religion in the public square that is not so doggone absolutist as the secularist position has become. You mentioned that in the 80s that even these kinds of discussions were taboo, right? You just don't cross that line. And the funny thing is, to me, what I see is maybe the Bill Clinton approaches was something of an exception to this, which may explain part of his success as a politician. That is that while the secular or the naked public square position has become just so dogmatic and rigid, actually the religious conservative argument has actually appeared often quite pragmatic and flexible. We're just asking for a little exemption in this area. We're not trying to draw big principles. We're not trying to extend the law into rights beyond what might be specifically enumerated, but a little common sense, a little, really, 10 commandments in this corner of a park is a violation? I mean, do you really want to take a stand on that? And many people on the left do.
Yeah. So a few things there. One, I share your premise that established fundamentalisms and epistemological monopolies are not welcome, whether from the far right or the far left in a postmodern pluralistic community. At the state level, the state should not be in the business of enforcing any of those. And we have, I think, in at least pockets of discourse in the last 10 years, been absolutist around purportedly neutral secular perspectives that are just as unforgiving and fundamentalist as some of the things that were replaced from the past.
Indeed.
Secondly, I one of the interesting things that the constitutional architecture of this One of the interesting things about the way the First Amendment works itself out is that when you have a free exercise clause that's strong and provides an oasis of nonconformity for your convictions and allows you to build a fence so that you can retain good neighborly relations with the folks next door, that it makes sense to then have an establishment clause that's rigorous and that will keep the state itself from being in the business of establishing a particular form of faith, right or left, traditional or new. Those things work well together. The sad reality, though, is that when the Free Exercise Clause or a statute is weak in providing exemptions, you nonetheless still have the Establishment Clause giving a person a single voice veto, a heckler's veto, over a law that may have been judiciously worked out at the legislative level. And so you can't use the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause as a drill to create a little oasis of nonconformity, but you can use the Establishment Clause as a sledgehammer to destroy a carefully choreographed legislative judgment about what's appropriate or inappropriate.
Interesting.
That can't work. And the third thing I would say is that one of the interesting things that has changed, I think, in the last 4 or 5 or 6 years is that at the national level, we tend to now have a little more plurality in the way that we think about some of these religion and politics matters. But at state levels, we're getting some of the sharpest and harshest forms of this one-sided absolutism. And that's the beauty and the bane of federalism, of course, but it's an interesting phenomenon over the last few years, and some of that may just be a reaction to people's views of the current politics of the day, but a lot of it is an interesting shift in dynamics, not of separation of powers, but of federal versus state power on questions of religion and politics. And that's normal. These are hard questions.
It would be interesting to do a survey of all the people who serve on human rights and civil rights commissions in all the states and to ask them about their religious opinions.
Yeah.
And see how many of them come down, how broadly those opinions range.
Yeah, that would be an interesting question. I mean, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission in the Baker case clearly had an agenda. I think we have to be careful in imputing an agenda to every other civil rights commission. Civil rights groups are important. They provide avenues of relief and release for folk that are caught in contexts where there's a majoritarian monopoly or a majoritarian tyranny even. But query whether they are being pursued across the spectrum of civil rights concerns as opposed to particular ones that are getting stronger and stronger attention, sexual and same-sex liberties being prominent amongst those.
Let me ask one more question about the center before turning to the other topic I want to get to, and that is, has the center been involved in any litigation?
No.
Have you advised, you know, the Alliance for Defending Freedom, any of the groups working on religious liberty cases, or members of Congress or state legislatures?
Yeah. Individual faculty members in the center have certainly been involved as expert witnesses, as advisors to Congress, sitting on committees as experts, sometimes testifying in given cases. A few of them have written amicus briefs, participated in litigation. But the center, and that's welcome and an important part of the professional service that each of us renders. The center qua center takes no party line, does not involve itself in legislation, lobbying, or litigation. And part of that is playing to our strengths. We're an academic and educational institution, not a lobbying group. Part of it's also recognizing that it is our job to try to provide the academic resources for the litigants and lobbyists and legislatures to begin to do their work domestically and internationally. And the more we become associated with a particular cause, the less, not objective, but at least the less authoritative some of that contribution can be.
You lose some credibility,
yeah.
Right? You lose some trust on that. So I think we need the Alliance for Defending Freedom. We
Absolutely.
Also need the Center for the Study of Law and
the
Religion.
The Beckett Fund, the Christian Legal Society, right. Anti-Defamation, there's some wonderful groups out there that are doing some really important work at all the levels I've mentioned, litigation, lobbying, and legislation. All those are important offices that need to be discharged in our democratic polity the way it's currently arranged. But each plays to his or her own strengths, and our center plays to the strengths of being academic and educational in its mission.
Great. Okay. You've got a series of books, that the Cambridge Law and Christianity series. What is that?
Yeah, so it's we've had a few different series, and we've had a few clusters of books. We've published 350 or so in our 35 years of work.
Wow.
But what we decided to do was to respond to a need that we're beginning to face in our own work, but more importantly, seeing in the field globally. And that is, law and religion discussions became increasingly in the scholarship. Law and religion discussions became increasingly a bunch of Jews and Christians and Muslims talking past each other in anthologies that combine Abrahamic perspectives on a given thing. They would whisper to each other a bit in footnotes. There would be a heroic introduction that sought to identify common threads. But for the most part, we were not getting the kind of synergistic engagement with the hard questions of public, private, penal, and procedural law, legal theory, political theory, social theory, and the like, that we thought the field at this point should be able to reach. And we began to realize that one of the reasons for that is that each of the three great traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and then anecdotally we also saw this with Confucianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, indigenous religions, many of those folks in those traditions didn't know the contributions of their traditions from text and experience till today on fundamental questions of law, politics, and society. And so with our friends at Cambridge University Press, who wanted us to create a new series, we argued that rather than creating a 10th or 15th such law and religion series and crowding various things together that really were tubs on their own bottom and chapters within those tubs on their own bottom, why don't we work deliberately to create a law in Christianity, law in Judaism, law in Islam, and other sets of series in the world religions, and create them with an architecture that would allow, first, a deep engagement with the texts and experiences of those traditions, as communicated, amongst other things, in the teachings of their great prophets. And so great Christian jurists is what one of our sub-series within Law and Christianity is about. A second is to say, what does this tradition, historically and today and in future, say about all the quotidian questions of law? Public law, private law, penal law, procedural law, labor law, environmental law, immigration law, and the like. And so we decided to create, as a second part of this series, a set of introductions, Christianity and we have natural law, family law, criminal law in the print now or in production, and there will be 20 other such introductions. And then third, a gathering place for individual monographs as they come to us from individual scholars, translations and the like. And so we have, amongst other things, a huge new book by Philip Reynolds, my colleague, on why marriage became a sacrament and how marriage became a sacrament, a massive 800-page study. We have books on care for the world, reflections on Laudato Si. We have a two-volume work on Christianity and freedom. We have a set of interesting titles by my wife's husband on the Western case for monogamy over polygamy and church, state, and family, and a future one on the Reformation of Rights II, which is a continuation of the story I've told in a Cambridge Press book before on Calvinist contributions to rights talk for the 16th to the 21st century.
Do you see one of the functions? The real function is to do good scholarship. But one of these side implications of it would be to provide another history and genesis of the law besides the Enlightenment one.
Yeah.
The secular Enlightenment one, right, that gives us the Thomas Jefferson cutting out all the divinity from the Gospels.
Yes. So as part of it's a prehistory, no doubt, and going from biblical times through to the Enlightenment is part of the burden of the series, to explore biographically, topic by topic. But part of it's also to engage reconstructively. What does this Christian faith and all of its diversity have to say to questions today? And how, alongside Jefferson and the Enlightenment tradition, do we see the Christian church in all of its particularity engaging deep, hard questions? What all those great jurists were doing? What are all those great social and religious and activist movements around abolition, around civil rights, around women's rights, around environmental care, around poor relief? These are animated by deep religious Christian in particular conviction, and unpacking all that and adding to the story that the Enlightenment historiography has given us, which is an important story, but adding to it all the other streams of contribution to our fundamental questions of law, politics, and society.
Have you ever heard of a survey, gosh, it might have been 10 or 15 years ago, of writings during the years preceding the founding that reviewed them and counted the citations?
Yeah.
That the top one was not John Locke, it wasn't Montesquieu, it was Leviticus.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Or different. It certainly was the Bible.
The Bible. Yeah, Don Lutz's book.
Okay.
The Origins of American Constitutionalism. Number one, by far, outstripping the next five
right.
in terms of citation count,
right.
was the Bible.
Now, I remember hearing one criticism of that saying, well, but they're looking so much at ministers and their sermons. And my response to that is, well, this is where much of the political discourse
sure.
took place
yes.
in the churches and the clergy writing about these issues.
Yeah, and the clergy were learned divines who participated in all aspects of life. They weren't sequestered to their parsonages, crafting sermons only for the Sunday.
Right.
They were writing political sermons, election sermons, sermons at funerals, all of which were designed to bring the richness of Scripture and tradition to bear on the questions of the local, sometimes state, sometimes even national polity.
Right.
And not to forget how many of the founding fathers, dare I say even mothers, were very active in their churches, and some of them were ordained clergymen.
Right. Even Franklin wanted to put Moses on the national seal, wasn't that right?
Yes.
Right.
I don't know, Franklin or Hamilton, I'm not sure which one it was.
Jefferson might have wanted to. I'm going to check that.
But, well, Moses shows up on the frieze in the U.S. Supreme Court, which is not unimportant.
He's the lawgiver.
He's a lawgiver.
Right.
It was thought to be a normal part of our discourse. And you can't do a bleached and bland historiography of the founding era and simply pick out a few of the anticipatory strands of,
right.
of later secularism. If you look at the
full range
of traditions.
You can if you've gone through an education, including a graduate education, and never had the Bible come up.
Well, it makes it easier. And to be fair to some of the folk that are the high priests of this new bleached historiography, many of them were raised in public schools that abstemiously separated church and state. And religion was not permitted, especially the Christian religion, was not permitted as a staple part of the curriculum of any kid sitting in grade school or high school. You get 12 years of that, and you're told that's what the First Amendment requires. You've created a bit of a genetic code for the next generation of reflexive secularism.
I
think the reality is all those folk raised in that 1970s to 90s atmosphere are the folk that are now the great intellectual and political and social leaders of our day.
But they're following
their instincts.
But you think that there is a turn toward more incorporation of religious issues, themes, consideration? Did you imply that before?
I think so. The notion of neutrality or secularity, the notion that we could have a religion-free, deep discourse about fundamental questions of family, of cloning, of
Without,
war, of environment, how you can do that free from the input of great faith traditions, cultural,
right.
philosophical traditions, as people have begun to realize is just a non-starter. And John Rawls, Jürgen Habermas, some of the great scions of that one-track version of epistemology in the 1960s through 80s or early 90s, in their last years of writing, have begun to retreat. And I think it's a reflection of a growing recognition that any complex issue that we engage, even in political and public life, with a constitutional constraint of the Establishment Clause, has to take religion seriously.
I think you're right. I see that. But I see that this is something of a crisis for liberalism. It's working through that recognition, and I mean I see symptoms of this. For instance, under Obama, there were some people arguing that churches ought to lose their tax exempt state. Why should they be get anything that others don't? But I see that as a almost acts of desperation or the feeling of religions coming back.
I think it's a function of coastal elites. I think it's a function of later life philosophers who are pressing, not desperately, but at least fervently, some of their 1960s through 80s convictions. I think it is an ideal that liberalism would like to maintain. It's a, some would say, an idol to be worshipped, but certainly an ideal that needs to be continually articulated, if nothing else, as a prophylactic against going too far the other way. But I think the reality is people now realize that religious folk deserve a seat at the table, and that they have a lot of things to say that are important for the polity to hear, and that religious communities do not have to hide their Bibles in their briefcases, don't have to remove their yarmulkes to participate, do not have to shed their religious rituals in order to be viewed as authentic players. There's a lot of literature that argues contrary to that. In the First Amendment field that I happen to occupy a bit, there's a whole literature out there that wants to kill religious freedom as a separate category just because, as you say, tax exemption and other goodies that religious folk get are no longer deserving in this post-Christian, post-religious age. But I think those are maybe you're right, maybe desperate arguments of a way that's dying philosophically.
I think also they're political losers in America. This was great. I would love to have you on again because there's so much more to talk about. I'll say the Law and Christianity series there at Cambridge University Press website sounds like books that ought to be assigned in more classrooms.
That's their design. And we have put them out in paperback in some instances as introductions. We have a wide range of text that even if in current expensive hardback version will be out in paperback within a year. There are ebook versions and the Cambridge Core, accessible through any university library, opens all these materials up bite by bite, page by page, book by book.
Fantastic. Okay. Thank you, John.
My pleasure. Good to be here. Good to see you.